positions matters. Is it somebody who just does their job and goes home? Is it somebody who goes way beyond what their job is and actually does volunteering and takes active roles in doing what they do? That matters, because we all know, we all sit and go, oh, this is not great, but you don't do anything about it. You need somebody who's going to go and look around them and go, what systems do we have that are causing our courts to be inaccessible? What systems do we have that are causing justice to not be served? And look at those and be willing to do whatever it takes, the effort, the leadership to change those. And that's what we need. And we need somebody who's trauma-informed when they're making their decisions and understand that trauma, whatever kind it is, will go on with the person and may affect their behaviors and the outcomes of what is going to happen to them in the future.
You've been listening to an interview with Rima Gondour, who is running for Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge in the 4th District. Please remember to vote in the upcoming Oregon primary election. You can mail your ballot back by May 14th or bring it to any official ballot drop site by 8 p.m. on Tuesday, May 19th. This is Nat Moon for KBOO's News in Depth.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, for the working class, and by the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hey.
We're broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. We are both public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today in the studio is Mary King. Welcome, Mary.
Thanks a lot.
So let's just get started. Mary, tell us about your background as it relates to teaching labor unions and to economics.
Well, I spent my career teaching primarily at Portland State. I'm a labor economist, and so I taught in that field, especially focused on women, people of color, and working class people. And I taught some about unions, and then I was quite active in my own union, which was the PSU-AAUP, the Union of Full-Time Faculty at Portland State, and advisors and other people full-time. I was president and VP for bargaining. We authorized a strike for the first time in our history. It was a very exciting era, and I consider that we won. And then I would say, in terms of economics, I'm focused on labor economics and what creates change for people who are more marginalized.
Great. And now you are the vice president of the Oregon Center for Public Policy? Is that your official title?
That's the official title. Okay. It's misleading. It means vice chair of the board.
Okay, gotcha. So tell us about the Oregon Center for Public Policy. What is it, and what is your role there?
It's a really excellent organization. They intend to provide facts relevant to improving policies to better the situation of all Oregonians, really, but to make a more equitable, inclusive economy, really to aid lower income and middle class Oregonians. And they are probably the best single source. They're online for information, some of which we're going to talk about tonight, like who pays what taxes and what are the pros and cons of different kinds of policies that are under discussion, from the perspective of working people in Oregon, really.
So, Mary, can you talk about Oregon's history of school funding, and when did funding shortages start to become a noticeable issue?
Well, I know I'm talking to teachers, so I'm sure you you know this sad story all too well. But I would say that Oregon had relatively well-funded schools, really, for quite a long time, and it may mislead people who went to school themselves more than a generation ago. But with Measure 5 and the property tax reform, we started to cut funding for our public schools, and we've been cutting for a generation. And our K-12 system, the cuts are serious, and I spent my career at the public universities, and that's been 25 years of cuts. You just can't make cuts like that without expecting to see consequences.
So can you tell us about our current tax structure and specifically about corporate tax rates in Oregon?
Yeah, that's a really important question. People tend to take taxes for granted and not realize how it changes who's paying the taxes. And it's changed tremendously over the last, say, 50 years. 50 years ago, corporations were paying $1 in taxes to every $5.50 that individual households were paying. And that is now $1 in taxes to every $15 that individual households are paying. They're paying a much smaller proportion of the taxes overall. And it's because their taxes are tied to the federal income tax, and corporations have been able to lobby like mad to get huge tax deductions and that kind of thing. They're able to offshore their profits so they don't have to really report on the money they're making. So it comes into Oregon already much reduced, and then that lobbying has just continued in Oregon with a lot of tax loopholes and lowering rates. And now our budget is 85% paid by individual households. The corporate income tax at this point brings in less money than the lottery does. And you know the lottery is a tax on low-income people.
Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, are austerity and budget cuts the answer to our state funding crisis? Is there really a shortage of money in Oregon?
That is an excellent question, and it's absolutely the case that austerity is not the way to go. This is a self-created shortage. This is wherein there's no reason for us to have so little money funding our essential public services. To think that is to operate, I think, with a very archaic idea of who we are in Oregon. The Oregon economy has grown tremendously. People really don't understand how much wealth is in this state now. We've got, and I don't know how you would do it if you aren't driving around and seeing all these Teslas and BMWs and all kinds of things we never used to see on our streets.
Mm-hmm.
But I've looked at the numbers, and there are many more high-income people there who are not paying the kinds of taxes they should be, and the corporations are not paying the kind of taxes they should be. Huge, extremely profitable corporations that pay the same low rates that our small local businesses do.
But wait a minute. You're talking about these people that are driving around in these fancy cars. That means that we're raising people up, right? These are people that were poor, and because our economy is thriving, they're now doing so well, and tax cuts are just working so well that people are thriving and driving these fancy cars. Is that not how it's working?
Well, that's a sort of a lovely fairy tale that we'd all like to believe, but I think we know that our own schools and universities are not producing the people necessarily who are driving all those cars, that there's an awful lot of out-of-state hiring, and the work that Oregonians do tends not to be paid as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you could change 2 to 3 economic policies in Oregon, what would you change or put into place that would significantly help our poor and working class families?
There's a lot to say there, and I don't want to talk at the level of things that I don't think we could realistically do in the next 5 years, but I think there are huge things, bold things that we could do in the next 5 years that could make a tremendous difference. I would say the first one would be a massive state investment in public housing and all the kinds of housing that would imply, emergency housing, transition housing, and just building and buying housing to keep it affordable.
Mm-hmm.
That would be one big thing which we could do. We are far below our bonding capacity in this state. We hamstring ourselves. We don't bond. We don't have a state bank that would help us make those kinds of investments. So there are strategies we could pursue. The second one I think that we ought to be pursuing and that many other cities and states are pursuing is universal preschool for 3- and 4-year-olds. That's a tremendous source of opportunity. It gives the advantages most to the people who have least. It very much changes how well people can do in school, whether or not they're likely to end up on the wrong side of the law, having kids too young themselves. It's one of the single most effective policy strategies we can use to reduce poverty and increase opportunity in this state. And it's just not that expensive. We could be doing that kind of thing. Other places are. The third thing I would say is to create a system of apprenticeships that would create living wage pathways into living wage work for people who are not going to go to college or would prefer not to go to college, because right now college is the gateway to a decent standard of living, and that's just wrong. Everybody doesn't need to have a college education. We need to have training, we need to have work with employers, and we need to have a restructured wage structure that says, yes, if you come out of high school and you can go through an apprenticeship, whether you're male or female, you can end up with a living wage job.
And before we, I just want to do a follow-up question. You mentioned a municipal bank, and for people who are not familiar with that concept, can you talk a little bit about that? And I do believe there is an effort underway here to create a municipal bank.
Yes, absolutely. There's an effort underway to create a municipal bank, and there's been interest since the financial crash of 2008 in a state bank. I know a bit more about state banks. There is a state bank in the state of North Dakota, and it weathered that crash much better than it did Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a place to keep state money so that then we do not have to pay people either to manage our money. We can lend it to ourselves at lower interest rates. You can use it to capitalize a number of projects that then you can build on. For instance, housing. That's an incredibly capital-intensive effort, but if you can manage your own money, you have a far better chance to start up some sort of revolving fund that could be used to build housing.
Great. And just to sum up, so you mentioned public investment in housing. That would certainly help our students who are oftentimes mobile or even homeless. You mentioned preschool and you mentioned apprenticeship. All of those things would really be things that would be helping our children, right? Our families. So there's currently a Tax the Rich campaign that is looking at municipal tax to fund universal pre-K. Can you tell us more about that campaign? We understand that you are somewhat involved in that.
Sure. I think one of the most exciting developments locally in quite a while is the emergence and growth of the local chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA. They're up to 1,000 members and extremely energized and savvy, I think. It's the kind of force that could create some change locally, particularly that can then improve things here and be a pilot and a model for bigger efforts and efforts elsewhere. So the local DSA is looking at potentially a ballot measure for 2020 to run, to implement a tax locally, and the best developed idea is to do a surtax on the income tax. So you pay your state income tax, you pay your federal income tax, and to implement a surtax on that is your local income tax,
mm-hmm.
but only on the top 5% of households. So only on individuals who are earning $250,000 more a year, or joint returns, couples who are earning together more than $500,000 a year, and then to go up as pay goes up. So people who are earning quite a bit and then would pay a surtax on that income to benefit local programs.
Yeah, and I wonder how that will do when you talk about ballot measures. I get nervous seeing as what happened with Measure 97, and I wonder how that slogan "tax the rich." I wonder how that plays out around the state. Obviously, if you're a member of DSA or if you identify as a socialist, you don't have a problem with something like that. But I wonder, right now, I know that things are shifting, right? I mean, even the word socialism used to be considered, you know, a bad word not that long ago. So I'm just curious about how that slogan plays out around the state. If you go over to Eastern or Southern Oregon, if you say tax the rich now, is that resonating with some people out there too? I'm not expecting you to necessarily have the answer to that. I'm just saying that I'm kind of curious about how that is around the state. If you are just joining us, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Labor Radio. So Mary, another question for you. Can schools really lift...
Could I address that? I'd love to address the question you just raised, because I think it's really an important one to think about.
Yeah.
And I'd like to say just two things. One is, I think you're absolutely right that socialism is losing its stigma, especially among young people, as they've got the quadruple whammy of student debt and high housing costs and low wages and expensive childcare. Mm-hmm. I think the economy they see clearly is not working for a wide swath of them, and they're much more interested in alternatives than people have necessarily been in the past. The second thing I'd like to say is, I think, one is, I also agree, I would not lead with tax the rich myself. I think we're much better to talk about universal pre-K, preschool for everybody, mm-hmm. and here's how we're going to pay for it, because mm-hmm. we have a lot of money in this state and we can pay for it. And thirdly, I think you raise a really important point that statewide efforts are much more challenging potentially than local. And I think that we could pass something like this at the local level. Portland passed Measure 97. Portland passed 66 and 67 quite overwhelmingly. And I think we could, in Portland or the county or the metro area, really be bold about progressive policy. And in that way, we can set a model for the state rather than going after the state. The last thing on Measure 97 is that very much antagonized the biggest money out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, huge global corporations set a record for how much money they dumped into Oregon, because they did not want us to create an example.
Right.
Whereas I think it's very much harder to get big money concerned about people paying more income tax.
Mm, okay. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to ask is, I often hear this that schools are really the answer, or they're the sort of the gateway to the good life, right? And so my question is, can schools really lift huge masses of poor children out of poverty given our current economic system, or is the American dream just sort of a dream for a majority of Americans until we're willing to make some radical changes to our economic system?
Well, I know, speaking to two teachers, I know you know well the yeoman's work that is happening in our schools, with the schools attempting to be the be-all and end-all, because that's the institution that we have for kids right now, even as underfunded as it is. But I think you're really right to be skeptical. The schools cannot be an antidote for the disinvestment in people that is going on otherwise in the economy. You cannot take kids who are, as you say, I looked at the numbers, there's something like 10% homeless kids in Multnomah County in the schools. It's mm-hmm. astronomical. You can't have kids with that level of stress in their lives, with that level of instability, insecurity about food, about where they live, and have the schools compensate for it. You have to have effective anti-poverty programs in place and public investment in schools. And then you also have to have options for people at all levels of education.
Thanks.
So recently, the Oregon Center for Public Policy came out with a report titled "Oregon Teachers Are Underpaid." Can you tell us about that report?
Yeah, this was a really excellent report that goes along people are looking at all over the country, really, what the level of pay is for our teachers. And so it's being done in other states and nationally, and then by the Oregon Center for Public Policy in Oregon. And what they found, they did a somewhat sophisticated statistical analysis to look at how teachers are being paid compared to their comparators in the private sector. And what that means by comparators is really people with a similar amount of education, people of similar age who are therefore about as experienced in their fields of effort as our current teaching labor force. And what they found was that public school teachers in Oregon earn 22% less than workers like them in the private sector in Oregon. And they did that taking into account that teachers are unpaid and don't formally work in the summer. So they just looked at weekly wages while people were working and compared that. And then they also factored in what you'd think of as total compensation, because people are always saying, oh, but the benefits are great. You know, they counted that as compensation and said, even considering that, then teachers are paid 9% less. And there are two things to think about that. It's still quite an underestimate of how much less teachers are being paid for a couple of reasons. One is that counting teachers' compensation like that acts as if every dollar that gets spent, for instance, on the retirement system is compensation for current teachers. But we know that current teachers are not going to have nearly as good a retirement as the people that they're actually paying for, because public employees, current public employees, are being charged to make up all the difference in the PERS system currently.
Yep.
I mean, you know, the business community loves to talk as if, quote, taxpayers were making up the difference, but who is making up the difference is everybody who works for the public sector, because their compensation, their benefit bill, what is considered their compensation, does not just go to their retirement. It's going for the shortfall in PERS, because the tier one, not because tier one is so super generous, but because in order not to put enough money into the pension system, they imagined that they could get 8% return. It wasn't the teachers who decided, sure, we can make twice as much as everybody else. That was the state. So the state said, and rather than fully fund the pension system, we'll just assume it'll return a really high return on investment. So that all goes in and gets counted as teacher compensation. But really, the real bottom line of that study is our teachers are significantly underpaid compared to people like them in the private sector. And sometimes people will hear a number and say, like, 9%, big deal. What's 9% out of 100%? It's a lot. It's a lot, because if you think of what that builds up to over a lifetime at the average teacher pay, that's $250,000. And if you had an extra $250,000, I think you'd be much more comfortable when you retire and as you live your life.
Yeah, and anyone who wants to argue that 9% isn't very much needs to go and talk to our school districts about that, because if we want to get a raise of 9%, boy, 9%, that would be a whopper.
Well, I also want to point out, too, when we talk about even considering during the working months of the school year, we don't work a 40-hour week. I mean, there are so many hours of uncompensated work that most teachers do throughout the year. So that's also a big chunk of lost wages.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about the gender pay gap that is mentioned in this report?
Yes. And there are a lot of ways to think about it. There's a gender pay gap that is among individuals within an occupation, and that's what they're talking about when they say there's not a gender pay gap in teaching. And to some degree, that's true, in others, they're missing the fact that when you get promoted or you move up in your career out of teaching, you become administration, and that the principals are far more male than the teachers. So if we don't look at that part of it, you don't see the gender pay gap in teaching to the extent that it is. The other thing, part of the gender pay gap, is that occupations that are female dominated are more poorly paid than occupations that are male dominated that really require the same kind of qualifications and effort. And that part of the gender gap is actually not captured in this study. So there is a bigger gender gap than is being reported, and there is a bigger pay gap than is being reported, because this study uses a methodology that takes that part of the element out of account, how much they're not, they are effectively comparing private sector workers who are in occupations as female dominated as teaching by the structure of the statistical analysis. So they're missing part of it. So the gap should be bigger. But it's absolutely the case that occupations that are identified with women and primarily worked by women are underpaid, and the more female they become in transition, the worse they're paid relative to their peers. You can see that happening, for instance, in pharmacy and journalism.
Okay,
so what are the risks of underpaying educators if we're really focusing? Let's just start there.
No, that's a huge and very important question, because you would almost get the idea that people think it's a really special privilege they're going to offer you to let you teach their kids, rather than saying there is no more important investment in the future than that our kids become good at reading, writing, thinking, and all the aspects of that. So the value that teachers create is tremendous, and of course they're aided in that by parents and other people. But so there's that on one level. You want people to do a job that is tremendously important, and at the same time then you devalue it and you cut the pay and cut the pay and cut the pay. People have choices. It's not like the old days where if women had an education, they could either be teachers or nurses or librarians. Now they can be lawyers and doctors and engineers and other things. And if you don't make that teaching a livable situation, people won't do it. They just won't do it.
So just as a side note, I mean, if we're really focusing, well, it's not a side note, if we're really focusing on fairness for school employee pay, we also need to prioritize educational assistants, cafeteria workers, custodians, secretaries, bus drivers, and many of them only make half of what a teacher makes. Today I heard a cafeteria worker tell me that the head kitchen worker at her school has been working for 20 years and only makes $15 an hour. So that is not compensating her years of work and service. But the last question we have time for quickly is, what about class size? Can we really reduce class size and pay teachers what they deserve?
Absolutely. We have some of the biggest class sizes in the country, as I'm sure you're aware. And class size is one of the things that people talk about first. If you want to improve education, you have to bring down class sizes. Kids need more attention than anybody can provide them in a class that size. But absolutely, we have the wealth. I mean, it's ridiculous. We're at so-called richest country in the world, at the richest point of our history, and yet we talk about being able to afford less than we provided the baby boomers. How can that possibly be? What we have instead is a refusal to tax and raise revenue in the way that we did for decades. Corporations and wealthy individuals are paying less in taxes than they did for decades in this country, and that's the source of the real problem.
Well, thank you so much, Mary King, for joining us on KBOO, and thanks to our engineer, and thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes, and you've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 o'clock to catch another Labor Radio show.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Welcome to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Oregon will hold its primary election on May 19th. Oregonians will vote on positions including district attorneys, sheriffs, and judges, as well as ballot measures that are important for public safety reform. We'll talk about these races and COVID-19 in the prisons with my guests from Partnership for Safety and Justice and Safety and Justice Oregon. My guests are Shannon White, PSJ's Deputy Director, and Talia Gadd, Director of Communications. Welcome, Shannon, Talia.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Karen. It's good to be here.
Now, Shannon, we're in the midst of a pandemic, and you're managing to continue PSJ's work for public safety reform. So how are all of you at PSJ? Are you all staying safe and well?
Karen, thank you for asking. We are, all started working from home. We're fortunate that our work lends itself to, if not perfectly, but actually be able to, we're able